Hello, you are listening to Therapy Insiders Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. As I'm sure you already know, based on the title of this podcast and social media and wherever else you see podcasts, that we will be interviewing Dr. Stuart McGill on this podcast. And that's coming up, and I think you will enjoy it. But before that, I'd like to do a little intro to this episode. And you're tuning in with probably anticipation of different perspectives from us and Stuart, and you might even have a bias of what you want to hear and how you will react to it before you do. As you know, Stuart has his own perspective, obviously, and he's been doing it for a while, and he's produced a lot of good stuff for the field of physical therapy, for rehab, fitness, a lot of different professionals. Really respect what he does. So our goal was to see how he incorporates some pain sciences and some approaches and communication, because at the end of the day, we all share a common goal: getting people better, getting people feeling better, and moving our respective professions forward. And I hope we, with this episode, help accomplish some of that. And before we jump into it, I'd like to announce that we're proud to sponsor PT Pub Night at CSM in February. Check him out on Facebook and definitely RSVP and come hang out with us. We'd love to chat with you face to face. So before we get into the podcast, let's hear a word from our sponsors. Therapy Insiders is proudly sponsored by WebPT, the ultimate EMR. But aside from being the ultimate EMR for physical therapy and the rehab community, WebPT also produces incredible content in a wide variety of topics. One such content piece I was really curious about was feedback. So I asked Heidi Janenga about that. Stick around to the middle of the episode to find out what she had to say about professional feedback. Therapy Insiders is also sponsored by Patient Sites, the leader in physical therapy, website, newsletter, and Facebook marketing. Stick around to the middle of this episode where I asked Scott, the president of Patient Sites, what really gives a website substance, because just having a pretty website is not enough anymore. You definitely want to hear that answer. And now, on to Therapy Insiders. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders, part of the UpDoc Media family. I'm Dr. Gene Shirakabrad, here with one of my partners in crime, Dr. Ersin Religioso. Urs, how's life?
I'm well, Gene, recovering from a couple weekends of courses. One hosted by you, and the next was in Toronto, and taking a month off from traveling again. So it's been great, but it'll be nice to spend the holidays with my family. How about you?
Same. It's been a hectic period. We're recording this episode, again, committing more cardinal sins of podcasting. We're recording this episode right about a week or so before Christmas, 9 days actually.
But yeah, did I say holiday? Sorry about that.
You did. How dare you? But the episode will probably air right in the new year. So we're kind of straddling that point between end of 1 year and the beginning of new year. And I talked a little bit about it on the previous podcast with John Childs. I always get excited by the start of a new year because it's, one, you get to reflect on things that you've done and the successes and the failures, and if you've met your goals, and if you're not writing down your goals, you're making a huge mistake. But it's that feeling of a fresh start. Now, I'm not a big fan of New Year's resolutions, Urs, because I think you kind of set yourself up to fail, and it's a short-term, short-sighted view. But I do like yearly goals. And do you do anything like that? Do you set goals for the year?
I don't know about setting goals for the year, just that I always have a vision in my mind where I want to be, where I want my various brands to be, who I want to potentially partner with and align, like strategic business alignments with, where I want my blog to be, et cetera, et cetera. So I just have an ongoing vision. I've never actually written formal goals. It's just that I'm just always trying to move onward and upward, and I just know where I want to be. And then when I get there, I'll just raise the bar a little higher. That's kind of
that's the way to do it.
Yeah, it's I started actually writing down goals for the year and doing a what I call a personal audit of the year before, not just business stuff, but actual personal stuff, things that I feel like I've grown personally, things that I need to still improve in. And I think it's a big thing to do to establish longevity in your career and longevity in your personal growth. And it's hard to do. It's hard to have a long, prolific career in any field, especially in the health and fitness field, because a lot of people burn out, information changes, and it gets old after a while just doing the same old stuff. So very few people, very few unique individuals can maintain that and get better. And lucky for our listeners, Urs, we have one such individual on the podcast today that defines longevity and growth and some really, really groundbreaking information in terms of health and fitness. And so keep our tradition going. How about you introduce our guest?
Well, we are very lucky today to have on Therapy Insiders podcast, Professor or Dr. Stuart McGill. He is renowned throughout the sports med world and fitness world for teaching seminars internationally. He just got back from a whirlwind Asia trip. How was that trip, Dr. McGill?
Well, good morning. First of all, Urson and Gene, it was a fantastic trip, but I don't know whether it's just I'm getting up there or not, but I suffered awfully with the jet lag when I got home. But anyway, I'm firing on all cylinders today.
Now, you are renowned for many, many things, and I'd like to speak about the first one, probably the most renowned, what you're known for more than anything else, and might be the most impressive thing. Is obviously I'm talking about your mustache. I would love to hear the story.
We're just
jealous. Yes, I would love to hear the story of when you decided to grow out the mustache and any interesting tidbits that have come over the years with the mustache.
Oh, wow. I've never been introduced that way, but that's got to be the best one ever. Geez. Well, I've only ever been clean shaven once in my adult life. So I either have a beard or some mess on my face, I guess. But I did shave the mustache off once, and I showed up to put on a clinical course, and the delegates were so upset and mad that they had heard about this thing and they wanted to come and see it. So I realized afterwards. It was a bit of the showbiz gig, but I've had people, they pick me up at the airport when I arrive somewhere, and they'll say, no, we had no idea what you looked like. We were just told to, you'll see a mustache, and when you see it, you'll know it. That's it. But, you know, the other side of that, which is kind of fun, is my wife hates it. She calls it wife repellent, but I don't know. This is the dance I have to do.
It's the constant struggle between the professional and the personal. It's a brand identity. It's got its own tax ID, and yet the wife doesn't like it. It's that tough.
Well, I think we're all really lucky. You know, in this day and age, at least for the past 10 years or so, it's okay to have a decent amount of facial hair in a professional working environment. So it's okay for all of us, you know, who are too lazy to actually shave every day. I love that trend. You brought it back, Stu. Is what happened. You made it popular.
It's a style cycle. I feel the style right now is coming back like the 80s. I feel like the 80s in terms of the wardrobe is coming back, and it's like the cyclical thing with fashion. But it's not only fashion. I feel like it's fitness and health in general. That's things that become taboo cycle back, repackaged and reformatted in a new way with a new name. And people buy it up again, people that didn't either know it before or didn't like what it was called before, but you call it something new and it's all of a sudden really, really the new hot thing again.
If you go back to the strongman training approaches in the 1800s, and then you look at some of the fantastic strength and fitness and training science that came out of Russia or the former Soviet Union in the 50s and 60s that just wouldn't pass muster in terms of being a published paper today. It is fantastic stuff, and you're right. What's old is new again.
That's how it comes around. So let's start off, let's get back into the world of health and fitness, as much as I would love to talk fashion and facial hair with you for 30 minutes. I think our listeners would appreciate your perspective on some of these things. And you brought up strongman. So one of the big questions that I have, and we talked a little bit about this with Chad Cook on the podcast before, is the whole idea of physical therapists and exercise. And you know, we are supposed to be known for movement. We're supposed to be known for exercise and owning that field. And I really don't think we're there. And I think the strength and conditioning field and the fitness field obviously has their strengths, pun intended. But if we combine physical therapy knowledge of the nervous system and mechanics with the knowledge of strength and conditioning coaches, I think that's a really powerful thing. What do you see in your teachings and your courses? How can we bring physical therapy and exercise to a next level and combine the two?
Oh, so this is a process question. How would you pull the two together? I'm just going to preface that by saying this. As you know, I have no allegiance in particular to any specific group, be they physical therapists, chiropractors, physical medicine docs, neurologists, or strength and conditioning coaches. My mantra has always been fill your toolbox with as many tools as you can, and there will come a time where it's most appropriate to pull out a specific tool. Now, that tool might have come from the world of strength and conditioning, it might have come from neurology, or it might have come from physical therapy. But if you try and become a training expert or a spine expert, whatever it is, I try and avoid those barriers. And I guess that's the way I would put together this amalgam and answer the question. Don't worry about whether it's a PT approach or a strength and conditioning approach. Just learn them and recognize them. They're specific tools to serve specific purposes, and execute them with as much skill as you can.
Yeah, that's I completely agree. And I think sometimes it's just getting out of your own way in terms of an ego or perceptions, you know. And whether you're a clinician with a doctorate degree or a research degree, or you're a strength and conditioning coach that's been doing it for many years and does, you know, researches a ton and reads and perfects his craft, I think, or her craft. It's learning from the best and what they're doing and incorporating to what you're doing. And I agree with you. I think that's one of the best ways to go. It almost sounds like an eclectic approach, Erson.
Well, I can just hop in there, Erson. You know what's interesting? I get emails every day. Who have you trained in, and then they might name a country or a city that they live in, and who knows your system or could help us out. And I do have various people around the world, and they're surprised. I'll send them. I'll just give you an example. If someone calls me from England and says, "Who can I go and see?" I send them to a trainer and strength and conditioning coach. And they'll say, "But he doesn't have a medical degree." I said, "Yes, but he'll get your back better." So he's just highly skilled in assessing what the cause of the pain is and has enough tools in his toolbox that he can, first of all, stop the cause of the pain trigger, and then cleverly design a program to shore up the foundation around it. And I'd have to say he gets 19 out of 20 patients better than I send them. And I hate to say this, but here goes, better than any physician or anyone else that I would send 20 generic bad backs to. So there you go. It matters to me not one little bit their training. I just care if they are good, they know their stuff, and they have some good tools.
I think that's that's important for anyone to educate. And I get a lot of those emails too. And sometimes I can say, well, I've even trained someone in this particular area that you're talking about, but I can't even guarantee that they've implemented certain principles. Because to me, definitely, I think a lot of clinicians out there, or trainers, or whatever their profession may be, they're looking to expand their toolbox. But I think it's something you talk about, because you have yourself a 3-hour examination. That's not even necessarily about the tools. It's how you use the tools, how you implement them, and what your clinical reasoning is behind that. Because essentially, you just want to tell people you need to shop around for someone who's to the right of the curve, because most people are on top of the curve. And if you get one of those, they're not getting 19 out of 20 better, right? I mean, and I wanted to ask you about that, Professor McGill. Your 3-hour evaluation, you often talk about, you are probably not going to get my results, one, because you're not me. And I totally agree with that. I tell that to my audiences too, but you have to have a very thorough eval. What constitutes your 3-hour evaluation?
Well, I'll tell you what the goals are first. The goals are to precisely define the pain triggers of that individual. And then the second goal is to remove them. And it may be retraining a movement pattern. That may be the way they sit. It may be the way that they sleep. It might be their daily habits. It might be an overexposure in training volume. It could be all sorts of things. But that's the first order of business. It's not to prescribe exercises, to get rid of the cause. And then the final bit is to design a progressive program to rebalance their body and build a pain-free foundation. So that's the goal of it. So the assessment starts simply by sitting down and talking to them. And I will ask them, and I just say, tell me about your pain. That's the first question. And I assess the priority that they place. If they start telling me, oh, well, my pain is a 9 out of 10, I can tell you right away they're obsessed over their pain, and I know I then have to reduce their focus on the pain. But if they start telling me, well, you know, sitting hurts my back, it's the pain trigger, and then I have acute episodes 2 or 3 times a year. Someone puts a knife in my back, and then I'm out for 2 or 3 days, and it takes me a couple of weeks to recover, and then I'm fine again. I listen to that, and there's only one thing that could be, and it's a disc. It's a dynamic disc in their back that's triggered by a motion pattern that creates the hydraulics that will cause their particular pattern like that. So anyway, I ask them some key questions. Do you get pain when you roll over in bed? And if they say yes, well, they've got spine instability. So I then just take 5 minutes, think of what they have just told me. Now I organize the physical assessment. In all the time, I'm watching how they're sitting in a chair, taking their shoes off, walking up and down the stairs to the assessment room, how they open the door, all of these movement opportunities. And then, unbeknownst to them, I've got a pretty good idea of their movement habits. And as you know, you can, with a skilled eye, already form an impression of their stability, mobility continuum just by watching them move. And then I will, the physical assessment, I take 3 approaches to chase the pain. The first one, I perform provocative motions, postures, and loads. So I load them different ways, I posture them in different ways, and I get them to do different movements to get them to say, ah, that's uncomfortable. As soon as I create discomfort and I've got the pain trigger, I then try and do something to take their pain away. I might add bracing. I might change their posture. I might change neural tension with a neck posture or a leg posture or something like that. So then I move on usually to neural testing. If there's a bit of a stenotic spine or a bulging disc or something like that, I play with the femoral roots, the sciatic roots, etc. There are all sorts of very, very interesting neural tensions that, you know, you wonder why this NBA 7-foot-tall basketball star walks in looking at the ground. because that's not their usual demeanor. And then you find, well, the reason is they have a nerve trap, a lumbar disc bulge, but it's underhooking the nerve root. So unbeknownst to them, they never realized this before, but when they walk with their head flexed down, looking at the ground, it actually loosens up their back. So that's the second level. The third level, it will be very tissue specific. I will do, now there's no real physical test that says absolutely, without doubt, this is the right facet joint at L3, or this is, you know, an end plate fracture or a particular form or subcategory of disc bulge. But you can get pretty close. And it's at this point, it's like conducting a murder investigation where no one saw the murder being committed, but the evidence from so many different perspectives create a body of evidence that is so overwhelming. You've eliminated everything else. Guess what? It's a right-hand side disc bulge, posterior lateral. There's a slight tear to it with the twist delamination or whatever it happens to be. So by the end of all of that, I think I've got a pretty good and very precise read on their pain triggers. And then I'll say, well, look, every time you get out of a chair, you just replicated your known pain trigger. However, if you were to sniff air, lean forward through your hips, and pull your hips through as a strategy for getting out of the chair, you just eliminated your pain trigger. And then we'll go on to try and tune their bodies with appropriate mobility, stability, and there we go. So this will surprise a lot of the listeners, but I only see patients one time as a rule. And then either I pass them off to their clinician, or some of them are able to go at it on their own, depending on how savvy they are. A lot of them bring their own docs or clinician with them, therapist perhaps, and it's a matter of teaching them as well. But it's a hell of a long answer, but that's how it goes.
And before it goes any further, such as our follow-up questions, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors, WebPT and Patient Sites. Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT, the ultimate EMR. Aside from being the ultimate EMR, like I said in the beginning of the episode, WebPT also produces a ton of content. And one of the topics that I wanted to know about was professional feedback, because it doesn't really get talked about, but it's super important. And I asked Heidi. So Heidi, why is professional feedback important?
Well, Gene, professional feedback in particular helps us become better employees, managers, colleagues, and providers. It's mission critical when it comes to improving patient care and exceeding business objectives. So, during this month's webinar, the amazing Dr. Daphne Scott and I are going to define feedback, explore the reasons why people give and fail to give feedback, and present a model for giving and receiving feedback inside a PT practice, including actionable steps for creating a feedback-rich culture in your clinic. I hope everyone tunes in. You can register for free at webpt.com/feedback.
That's great and sounds like a no-brainer to me. So if you've never checked out a WebPT webinar, you're definitely doing yourself a disservice. So check them out at webpt.com/feedback. Therapy Insiders is also brought to you by Patient Sites, the leader in website development, Facebook, and newsletter marketing. I grabbed Scott, the president of Patient Sites, and asked him, what would you say are some really important elements of substance that a website needs to have?
Well, there's a couple of different components. So one is content. And by content, we're talking about moving beyond the clinic information. So things like patient education, video tours that are interactive, so things that engage people and provide more information than just what your services are. Another element is, which is more and more common these days, is desktop versus mobile. So making sure you're developing a strategy where people that are on a mobile device can navigate your content very well. If they happen to be trying to access your phone number, your location, making that very, very simple to access from a mobile device. And a third category is call to action. And that can be as simple as, is it really easy to find and click or access your phone number from any given page, all the way through to more advanced tools like appointment request forms or live chat, and finding different ways to engage people when they're on the site. So you want to move from the shiny elements that look good to making sure you're addressing the functionality and the things that people will actually respond to in terms of driving results from your website.
I agree. Don't focus on the shiny, focus on the results. Check out patientsites.com/insiders for more on content creation and website development. And now back to Therapy Insiders and our conversation with Dr. Stuart McGill.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what I expected. And I think, you know, the better of a clinician you are, your evaluation is going to be very, very similar. Whether you look at different things, we're all trying to basically find what the patient is sensitive to. Because in the end, you know, you call them triggers. And I would just tell a patient that pain is all about sensitivity. You know, 10, 15 years ago, I was very much into whether it was a facet or posterior SI ligament or a disc herniation or, you know, posterior lateral disc protrusion, because I'm also McKenzie trained and I've trained a lot of McKenzie certs and a lot of McKenzie diplomats. And, you know, it'd be very, very easy. And it was very easy and convenient when I could just say a patient was dropping D-bombs because of their MRI, and then I would just basically introduce a lot of placebo and say these exercises are going to potentially reduce that disc protrusion, and then I would intervene, I would show them something, maybe I would throw in a little manual therapy to make them feel better, and then when their pain centralized and their function came back and their mobility came back, then we would all just say, now your disc is reduced. But, you know, I incorporate a lot of pain science, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with Lorimer Moseley or David Butler or Adrian Liu or those guys in the physio world who promote pain science, but there's a growing body of research that makes it a lot more difficult for us who were kind of steeped in pathoanatomical reasons for pain and pain triggers, that you know, pain is really not necessarily it doesn't correlate well with what appears in an x-ray or a scan or an EMG, because there's so many false positives with that. Are you familiar with that research, or how do you incorporate that, you know, in terms of if you said disc and that actually promoted like a nocebo effect and someone would actually increase their fear avoidance, do you ever avoid using those things and just call them triggers, or do you pretty much stick to pathoanatomical explanations?
No, absolutely, I don't. What a huge question. There's three parts there, I guess. By the way, I know Laura very well, and I'm very familiar with that whole pain science, and I incorporate it very much, of course. But I can very confidently get to the level that if the pain is from the disc, I can isolate that. And if you can irritate the disc a certain way, and if that's the pain, and you irritate everything else, and that isn't the pain, and then knowing the mechanics of how to get the disc to resolve, and we can talk about McKenzie approaches, and I don't agree with some of them because I've proven what it actually does to the disc. We can talk about that if you want. However, I think we can get to the level of the disc. Let's talk about the pictures and the correlations for a moment. I agree with you 100%. The MR or the CT doesn't correlate with the presentation of the patient. When a patient first, let's say, damages a disc so it becomes painful, yeah, they may or may not see a change on MR, but then after 2 or 3 years, they get this terrible diagnosis of degenerative disc disease. They don't have a disease at all. It's just that the disc is a little flatter now. There's less water, and it's a little bit flatter. But this is the height of their pain. 2 or 3 years after, they have this discogenic back pain. But if you check back with them in 10 years, their MR looks even worse, and yet their pain is all gone. And the pain is gone because the joint no longer moves. It has gristled, and other joints are now taking up that movement responsibility. And they may be coming, the painful ones, but that original one that looks horrible on MR is no longer the pain generator. So that's why there's really very poor correlation between the picture and the further you moved along in the pain degenerative cascade over years, that relationship just gets worse and worse. But the whole pain science, and you mentioned Lorimer Moseley, there's two really major concerns with that whole area. I know not Lorimer, by the way, I admire his work very much, but there are others who've taken that philosophy and say, oh, keep teaching the patient to move because you don't want them to become kinesiophobic or afraid of movement. And my view on that is it's just because they've had poor coaching. We, on the other hand, would identify their pain triggers. I may never mention a facet joint to a patient, but I will say that extension and rotation is your pain trigger. So every time you do that, naturally, you're going to hurt and you will avoid that movement. However, we're going to still get you to brush your teeth, get in and out of your car, do the things that you want to do in a way that doesn't create the pain trigger. And now the person is quite the opposite. They're not afraid to move. They've just simply found a way to avoid the pain trigger and remain very able. But the last bit of this is now we're getting into real neuroscience, which is a lot of fun. Let's say a person has a very sensitized nervous system. So if they do some minor little movement, their back hurts or gets triggered. They're highly wound up. It's called central sensitization. You just touch them and they will flinch or experience a little pulse or muscular response or a pain shot. We measure that with EMG and whatnot. However, if they keep moving and are encouraged to keep moving in a way that causes that neural response, the trigger actually decreases. So less and less stimulation will then cause that pain. In other words, they're winding up central sensitization. But if you stop triggering that pain, the nerves will naturally wind down their sensitivity. So it takes more and more stimulation to trigger them off. So after a while, they can start to make movement errors and do many more things without triggering the pain. So very much we are winding down their pain using to the maximum what we know about that pain science literature.
Right. That's a great answer. And I think a couple of my blog readers and people who attended my seminars, they wanted me to ask you that. And I think that's the best answer you could have given. I think no matter what our approach is, whether it's a movement-based approach, manual therapy-based approach combined with movement, I think that's what we're all doing. Especially it's difficult for someone who's centrally sensitized or even acutely peripherally sensitized, but your answer really satisfies me, because in the end what we're trying to do is show those really people who are very sensitive, because in the end my message is pain is all about sensitivity. It's okay to poke the bear a little bit. It's okay to do that, and the more you do that, the less, a graded exposure approach, essentially, the more you do that, the less threatening your nervous system will perceive that input. And then, like you said, you can't afford to be a bit more sloppy. But in the end, I think it's most important to show the patient that it's okay to move, and regardless of our approaches, I think that's what all of us are trying to do in rehab.
Yeah, well said. I guess my only emphasis here is are people who differ from you and I and say, oh, no, let's just get them moving right off the bat. And I'll say, nope, I'll disagree with that one. You will be winding them up even more as you keep allowing them to trigger their pain, clean up their movement, reduce the movement triggers, and then follow what we've just said. But, right. This is a bit of a summary of this whole point in that 3-hour assessment answer a few seconds ago. I don't see the average back pained patient. they see the you know, whatever clinical route they decide to take. I only get the ones who've been to 10 different clinicians and have failed. I get the tough cases. So I have to be very thorough and very cognizant of all of these different approaches, because I know that a lot of them will come. It's like someone trying to lose weight and they've tried 10 different diets. They're just conditioned that they're going to fail the next time. So anyway, maybe that gives a bit more of a perspective of why I have to proceed the way I have to, because I do get special back pain patients. They're not just the generic easy ones to fix, let's say.
So something we can all agree on, regardless of our field and degrees and, you know, any other badge of honor that we go after, is that good communication is critical for every single healthcare and pretty much any profession or business. You need to be able to communicate clearly so the person that's sitting in front of you understands. Not communicating that you know all the stuff, that you know all the research, that you know all the mechanics, but communicating it in a way that they process it and make it relevant to them. And that's what it comes down to, is making that connection with the person so they know what's going on with them, how you can help them, and the plan that they and you can agree on. And that's very tough. That's not an easy thing. And I think you're doing something that's a bit unique in approaching that, right, Stu? You've written a ton of books, you've written textbooks, but you're going after it from a different angle now, about educating a broader audience of people that could be in pain and have back issues by writing a book geared towards actual lay people. And correct me if I'm wrong, it's called The Back Mechanic, and it should be coming out soon on Amazon, I believe, from what I saw. Can you give us a little glimpse of the book? What made you want to switch gears from kind of writing the textbooks and going after the professionals to the people?
Well, that's a nice observation from a master communicator like yourself.
Getting there.
Well,
getting there.
Yes, I had written only for clinical audiences before now, and I never felt comfortable writing for the lay public, because I just didn't feel as though I had those skills. But I kept getting asked, can you write a guide that's consumable for the lay public? So I wrote this book, Back Mechanic, but to be very frank, I needed very good editors to present the material. I was okay at packaging it and making it into a step-by-step process, but to remove my medical jargon, that's very difficult for me to do. Anyway, fortunately, I got some good editors, and the feedback we've been getting, it's been out actually a couple of months, and it's been very good feedback from the lay public, saying, great, that this is guiding us through an assessment, a removal of the cause, and then a progressive program to build a foundation to avoid back pain. Anyway, there it is. It's coming out on Amazon as we speak this week. So,
well, for our listeners that, again, this episode is probably going to be airing right after the new year. So you've collected a gazillion Amazon gift cards by that point from Christmas and the holidays. So go over to Amazon, check out Back Mechanic by Stuart McGill, and get yourself one, buy one for a friend, and start reading it. Let us know what you think. So that's our hashtag Project PT, is check out Stuart's book. So what do you say we finish out with a couple Twitter questions? We had one from Andrew Rothschild at A Rothschild PT, and he kind of, Urson and you guys already kind of covered the pain sciences. So his question was how you incorporate pain signs into your biomechanic assessment of patients. And I think you already answered that. So Andrew, thanks for your question. And Steve Novashen, MPT at Novashen, asked how your hip is doing these days and if you have any new advice on the big three.
Wow, a little bit of personal and a little bit of science. Well, yes, I did have to get my hip replaced. I'd broken it as a kid, and it just finally it became so arthritic it gave out on me. So it did take a year to get it where I am really enjoying it now. No limp. Having gone through that whole process, it wasn't easy as my friends told me it was going to, because most of the guys with my background have either got new knees or new hips now. But anyway, there it is for that. But big three. Let's talk about that by saying they are very simple exercises in concept, but a lot of science went into developing them. The science that went into them to find an exercise that guaranteed stability of the spine, and to do so in a way that was very spine friendly and tolerable, and then to prescribe them on sets and reps that would be most therapeutic. The developments, not really. We put a lot of science into developing them. The science hasn't changed, and the exercises haven't changed. So in back mechanic, if we can go back to that, I put a lot of nuances in there. For example, some people might get neck pain when they're doing the modified curl-up, for example. So there are some remedial exercises in there, and little patterns. For example, if someone's experiencing neck pain and their sternocleidomastoid is sticking out of their neck and they clearly don't have much muscle activation in the front of their neck, we would then give the cue, touch your teeth lightly together, push your tongue hard to the roof of the mouth, and add a slight grimace to your jaw and neck. And most patients will say, ah, that gave me the stability that reduced our neck pain. But can I, you know, something's in my mind. Can I just get it out?
Go for it.
Okay, look, core stability. People keep asking me, what is it and what's its link to pain and why are these certain exercises good for it? Look, it's the bottom line is this. When a joint is injured in the back, it becomes a bit lax. That laxity creates micro movements. Those micro movements can trigger pain. A little bit of stiffness from the muscles, and stiffness is a word that the true absolute word is stiffness. Although that's got a negative connotation to some people, but we could replace that with a muscular tone. Nonetheless, that stiffness or tone around the spine stiffens out the micro movements to reduce the pain. But the other thing now takes us into ability and performance. The stiffer the core, the more the speed and athleticism distal to the ball and socket joints. It makes better athletes. You run faster, you turn faster, you bend down and you pick up things with more proficiency and less pain. So it's very difficult for people to get this concept. But, you know, if you know what a backhoe is, if you're digging, a road up or a sure. sewer line or a stump out, they have stabilizers on them, and they are arms that come down onto the ground and lift the back tires up off the ground. They are stabilizers. They root into the ground. If the backhoe creates a stable foundation, you can then manipulate the hip, elbow, and wrist, as it's called, if you're a backhoe operator, of the backhoe. But if it's not rooted into the ground with the stabilizers, you can't dig, you can't pull rocks, and it's exactly with your core. We've measured this in virtually every athletic event, strongmen, etc. The stiffer the core, all the muscles that cross the shoulder and hip joints, they attach to the core on the proximal side. If you stiffen that side down, all of their actions are expressed distal to the ball and socket joints. So you run a little faster, you hit the tennis ball a little harder, and it's spine sparing. You're engineering out the micro movements. So sorry for that summary, but it is important.
No. Absolutely. I think
people to get those both sides of it.
Yeah, and I'll let Ersin chime in a second, we'll finish with that. But I feel like core has transitioned from a research health-based field into a marketing package for all kinds of industries. It's, you know, it has taken on so many interpretations and ideas that when you say core, it becomes almost a defensive and argumentative term at this point, because everyone has a different meaning to it. And it's troubling, because a lot of times people can think the same way, but because you have a certain perception of the term, which is why communication and language is so important. If you don't understand where the person's coming from, just saying core or abs or disc pain or things like that, you know, you can have a very negative reaction or a positive reaction. But either way, based on the perception of it and what's been done with it in other fields. So I think talking about it is great. And I think even better is defining it and making it relevant to the population and the people in front of you. What do you think, Urs?
Yeah, I think that my only problem with core is that, again, I mean, how are you describing it? How are you implementing it? And is it making any difference? I mean, I think core is one of those things that when all the timing research first came out and kind of revolutionized the fitness and the rehab industry, that now it became, and it still is to in many cases, this panacea. And I think we'd all agree there's no panacea in anything. And if bracing a certain way reduces the sensitivity to positions, movements, and functional activities, that's great. But, you know, we've all seen even some like world-class weightlifter who they can brace very well, and yet they still have pain. So obviously it's not the way they brace. They're still just doing something that repeatedly sets off their nervous system, and that's the thing. I mean, you can correlate it to pain, and if you do some sort of motor control or core strategy that doesn't set off the trigger for long enough for the nervous system to kind of settle down, that's great. It's just not this end all be all thing, and I think we would all agree with that.
There's things that a lot of people can benefit from, but I don't think there's one thing that everybody can benefit from, aside from maybe walking and drinking water, you know, and good sleep habits, just global things. But
good diet.
Right. Well, that's also a big global topic. So that's, you know, defining right. Good. So, yeah, absolutely. And Stu, I definitely look forward to hear more about Back Mechanic on Amazon. I'm going to check it out myself and see how it looks. And any closing thoughts for our listeners?
Yes, I do. How about this? As you know, I do a lot of interviews, and some of them are skilled and some of them aren't, but I'm going to comment on you two. I love the way you interact, and I love your interviewing skills. So thanks so much for all of what you do and the service you provide to the public. Well done, guys.
Well, thank you so much. I am going to delete the entire episode and just take that clip and play it on loop.
that's
the entire podcast. Thanks for joining us. And this is the entire episode. Stuart McGill praising us on our interviewing skills. That's it. So Stuart, again, thanks so much for joining us. And we look forward to reading your book, Back Mechanic.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. For our listeners, please check us out at updocmedia.com. Again, we've got the blog, the podcast. We got some videos coming out over the next several weeks to months. So we've been transitioning to a lot of new media things. And if you're a listening business, we're doing business marketing and consulting. We're doing digital media creation. If you need help with making the videos, if you're interested in getting a podcast made, definitely check out updocmedia.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.